Welcome to the Realizing Genius podcast. I'm your host, Heidi Christensen. This is where we dive in each week to chat about parenting, education, and realizing our children's genius. I'm an educator with a background in individualizing learning, and I'm obsessed with helping people find and nurture that genius in their children and themselves. Let's dive in. Hi, geniuses. Heidi Christensen here with the Realizing Genius podcast. I am so excited today. We get to talk to Bill Berger, also known as the homeschool dad and the Berger man. Bill, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I would like you to just tell us a little bit about how you became the homeschool dad. You've been in this journey about as long as I have.
My wife was a public school teacher, taught music in the public schools, and I was teaching adults, normal adults, how to become computer geeks and computer geeks how to become even bigger computer geeks. And then our life was changed because we had our first child. And partway through raising the child, we realized that we, although Leslie was a teacher, she didn't want Aubrey to be in the public school that she was teaching at. And she had a very good friend who was involved in homeschooling. And honestly, the only exposure I had to homeschooling was the not necessarily good stories of Hollywood children, people who were on TV shows and that, and how they were able to work while still children because they had either tutors or some form of homeschooling. Well, that homeschooling didn't always work out to create well-adjusted human beings. And maybe it's the homeschooling's fault. Maybe it's the Hollywood life fault. But, you know, living in California and actually having some exposure to people who grew up in that lifestyle, I was not in favor of homeschooling. But Leslie and her friend were able to change my mind, and we gave it a try. And I was public schooled my whole life. My wife was public schooled and private schooled while traveling. There was not a lot of English language schools available when she was living overseas. And so we had no experience with this, but oh man, what we found, what we got into was just so satisfying. And we were able to choose the messaging. We were able to let the individuals, we call them children, but they're individuals, let the individuals figure out who they are and how they are, can best be who they are. And you can mentor and coach and guide and help develop their genius. And it's just so satisfying. It's terrifying. It's horrifying. If you hear me tell this story like this is all candy and roses, and just there are moments that are absolutely beautiful, and then there are moments where you are terrified that you are doing something wrong, that you are not qualified to do this, somehow your children are going to be harmed because you don't have a PhD in English grammar, and how is the child supposed to learn anything about a sentence structure if they're not learning it from someone who has a PhD in English grammar. Those moments are all over the place, but boy, and I lived through it. I survived it. You can't see me on the podcast, but I got the white beard. I have three kids that we've got all the way through. My eldest is trying to break into a combined master's and PhD program in psychology. My other kids have college experience. They are doing just fine. They are in no way harmed by being homeschooled. And the amount of time we've been able to spend with the kids and the amount of, I don't know, the things they don't know they know is amazing. And all these other people say, how did you learn that? I don't know. Didn't you? That's just cool. So I don't know. I'm rambling, but I became known as the homeschool dad when I did a couple of videos on YouTube defending homeschooling. And probably my most viewed video has over 6,000 views. And it was just an open letter returning back. Somebody in San Diego was making their career by attacking homeschooling. And I responded, and people thought I was speaking truth to power. And I was just speaking truth to a person trying to get attention. And it worked.
Yeah.
I like being the homeschool dad.
Yeah. No, I love that video. I love all your videos. And how can people find those videos, in fact, on YouTube?
Oh, I'll come up with a link. I have a website, theburgerman.com. It's theburgerman.com. Okay. And there are a bunch of things that I do there, but one of them is a link to the videos, and that probably would be the easiest. So
perfect. Perfect, because I know there'll be people who want to see them. I love them. I've watched them many times. So you have several on there, not just about.
Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff. I talk. That's what I do.
Yeah, you talk well. Yeah, you've been on my presenter at my conferences, both in person and online, several times, and everybody loves hearing you talk. You have so much to say. It's awesome. It's awesome. Well, here on the podcast, I talk about genius and having a genius paradigm, which is seeing that genius in each person. How did you and Leslie do that in homeschooling, both with your kids, but also I know you were involved in our homeschool group and you worked with other kids. You even mentored a class for our homeschool group. So
yeah,
how do you do that?
That was fun. That was actually very satisfying for me. And I think the kids got something out of it, but it was very satisfying for me. Well, one of the things that's nerdy about me is I love language. I love the meaning of words. I love etymology. And I have the old 17th century dictionaries and stuff to look up and etymological dictionaries to figure out what the root meanings of words were. And we got involved with a homeschool group, and it had it. As its name, genius. What I associate with genius at that time, you know, this part of my journey was, you know, crazy haired Albert Einstein or somebody who is a genius at a particular art, the Yo-Yo Ma on the cello or whatever. These are people who have a ability to synthesize things that they're exposed to and come up with great new insights. And that's wonderful, but that's not the original meanings for genius. And there's been a big evolution of meanings for genius. And back in the day, I was hearing there's genius in everybody. And I was thinking, yeah, but some people can comb their hair and Einstein couldn't. I mean, I don't know if that I see that Yo-Yo Ma and everybody. My next door neighbor, love him, his son to pieces, but he was trying to learn the saxophone. Oh my, there was no genius there. There's genius in him, but not in his saxophone playing. It sounded like they were torturing small animals in the garage. So, not all Yo-Yo Ma's, but the Latin starts with the G-E-N-E, which means really in the beginning. It's the same root as Genesis or generations or genealogy, or they all come from that in the inception. And the Romans believed that a genius lived inside of everyone. It wasn't that everyone was a genius. It was that there was a genius in everyone. And in their old view of the world, of the universe, the genius was a beneficial deity or spirit that came into the being at birth and gave them unique talents and guided them. Later on, it became kind of like a Jiminy Cricket conscious thing that it taught you the difference between good and evil. And then the French kind of accidentally, it was not really a mistake or an act to confuse people, but they translated Arabian Nights from the Arabic and they found genies and genius, and they blended the concept of that disembodied spirit as a genie. And there was this genius confusion if you start looking into the etymology, but it was just an accident. It's the Arabic is using J's. It just sounds the same. And it wasn't until the 16th and 17th century that we started having this age of reason and this disembodying, getting rid of this spiritual concept of genius and imbuing a human being with a set of skills that it later became the way we call Yo-Yo Ma a genius or Einstein a genius or whatever. But while I'm recognizing the crazy haired guy as genius, I also very much like kind of the Roman idea. I don't necessarily believe it's some separate entity living inside of you that is genius, but I think of it more like it's your uniqueness. It's a person's unique essence is their genius. And some people think I'm talking about personality because I say there could be two twins and they're born at the same time. They have the same genetic material, the same parents, but they're going to develop differently. One might be excellent at softball and one might be excellent at watercoloring. And they say, well, yeah, but so you're talking personality. I'm like, I think personality is too superficial. What is that genius that we're drawing out of people? We're trying to help them to find it because I really do believe there is something in their core that might need some help, might need some legitimizing. And a personal story of my journey for decades, many decades, trying to figure out what I wanted to do for a living. And because of the culture I grew up in and the years that I grew up in the United States, it was common for a man to identify himself with his job. I was not Leslie's husband. I was not the father of my children. I would be a fireman. And there would be some sort of classic definition of fireman. And that's what dad was. Well, I was never a fireman, but I was trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to be, which was kind of associated with who it is that I want to be. But I wandered around doing all kinds of things for a lot of different people. But what I should have recognized was, and I went back and I guessed at the truth of this and had it confirmed when I went through some of my mom's stuff. She's still with us, but they've moved into another facility, moved into a smaller home, and they had all this stuff boxed up. And I said, oh, what a great opportunity. I pulled all of my elementary school report cards. I pulled my middle school report cards. So from elementary through middle school, every single one of them said some variation of Billy is a very bright child, but I do better if I just stop talking in class. Every teacher told me to stop talking in class. And in my maturity, I realized that what I do best is talk in class and that the teachers were trying to squash my genius because at my core, I speak in class and I made a very good living. People are pursuing a good living. I made a very good living by being the one talking at the front of the classroom, by being the person who's talked at the Anaheim Convention Center with, 15,000 people listening to me talk, because that's what the teachers told me to stop doing. But it's find that thing that you're really good at and find a way to draw it out and nurture it and to protect it and to keep the negative messaging away from it. Another thing that I was a victim of, that I think as of negative messaging, was I grew up, and most people today, especially, tweens and teens, we all want to be the same.
Yeah.
We all want to have the same lunchbox. We want to be like everybody. We want to be normal. Yeah. We want to be, my kids say that normal is just a setting on the dryer, but that there's no such thing as a normal person. It's because they didn't grow up in a normal house. but I spent as a youth a good amount of time worrying, and worry is never any good, worrying about what people were thinking about me. If I didn't have the money, if my parents didn't have the money to get me the really cool shoes and I wore last year's shoes or whatever, I wore clothes that my mom made for me instead of clothes that were bought at the store. I worried what people thought of me. And you know what? The terrifying truth for someone like me who needs a lot of attention is that people aren't thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves. They're all wrapped up in what their own challenges and worries. If you knew how little you mattered to most people in the world, it would be soul crushing. It would be sad if you feel that, oh, what are they thinking about? Oh, I did this. I'm so embarrassed. They're going to, oh, they're wondering what they're going to have for dinner. They're wondering how they're going to pay the electric bill. They're wondering about, there's just their life. That's what's consuming them. They're not worried about you. And if you, like me, the other part of my genius, I recognize is that I have an extraordinary need for attention. And so it's not that I stopped worrying about what people think about me. It's that I started realizing that people didn't think about me unless I gave them something to think about. And so I don't dress like anybody else I know. In this podcast, I'm wearing a leather top hat and a vest and a very long sleeve t-shirt, and jeans. So it's not just shabby chic. It's just, if people say, what do you call that look? I said, well, it's the Burger Man. This is how I dress. You're going to an event? No, just life. And I have all these other crazy outfits. And I realized that to be the foolish, if you're not afraid of being foolish, then you can get attention. But part of getting attention is not so hard, but it has a responsibility. What's the Spider-Man thing? With great power comes great responsibility. Or my kids watch the VeggieTales, with great chocolate comes great responsibility. Larry the cucumber character. So got the attention. What do I want to do with it? And so I decided I wanted to be that one guy. And so I've done a lot of talks about this before, but if I go in to the hospital for anything, and I know from my niece being a nurse, and I know from friends of mine who are MDs, the job is a lot of the same, but I want to be that one guy. If somebody says, hey, honey, how was your day today? Well, it's pretty much the same. Well, wait a minute. No, there was this one guy. And if they're telling this one guy story, they are thinking about me. Yeah. If they're telling this one guy story, and the one guy story is not, oh, there's this one real jerk who totally ruined my day. No, there's this one guy who showed up, and you'll never believe what he did. You'll never believe what he said, or you never believe how he made me feel. And that's other people benefit from, but I get a lot of charge out of that. I walk into this local grocery store and everybody knows me. I walk into places that I've only been once before and people know me. And my wife just thinks it's hilarious that almost everywhere I go, somebody thinks I own the place. I was at this very high-end restaurant inside the Mission Inn in Riverside, if you're not familiar where that is. Very nice place. I recommend it. I know Heidi's genius program isn't endorsing it. And I was in there in a Prince Charlie jacket, kilt, and top hat having dinner. Why? Because I felt like wearing my kilt and top hat and Prince Charlie jacket and my skein dagger and my sock and the whole nine yards. And we're having dinner. And people come by and they have convinced themselves that I am the eccentric owner of this hotel and restaurant facility. And they want to tell me about their great experience. And I don't own it, but I don't look like anybody else in the place. They're trying to figure out why I would be like that. And, I get the attention. I like that. The last bit to tag onto the public school teacher doing their job, but trying to get me to comply with the not talking in class thing. I have very successful friends, one of which is an Academy Award winning animator. He's done a lot of films that you will know. I'm not going to name drop them, but he was in trouble all the time. His report cards were telling him that he needed to spend more time paying attention to the lecture in class and less time doodling, because he got good enough grades, but he was drawing. And at one point, his dad, who didn't get the idea, told him that he should just man up and stop doing all these doodlings and get a real job, become an accountant or something. And my friend kept doodling and has a very nice lifestyle, very happy doodling for your pleasure and using, you know, multi-billion dollar film projects as his doodling pad. And why not? And another person was in the physical arts and was making things out of, back then we used to wrap our school books in brown paper from the grocery bags.
Yeah.
And he would always be tearing off pieces of the ground paper, making them wet with his saliva and making little sculptures and other things in class. You know, we would probably label him ADHD or something, but he was smart as a whip and he wasn't failing in school, but the teacher found it insulting that he wasn't giving his full attention to the teacher and he needed to stop with all that distracting. He's good, but he could be even better if he stopped all this stuff. Well, you can go into California and in New York to visit one of his galleries. He is a very successful artist and he has published a series of books and will be on the guest list for the funeral for the Queen, because when I was at the Buckingham Palace, the one time and only time I was there watching the changing of the guard, I texted my friend who was sitting inside having breakfast with the royal family. And I said,
"Wow,
you're answering my text while at the breakfast table with the royal family? Shame on you. You should have your cell phone put away." But I'm like, you know, the nearest I got to any of that stuff is I'm watching the guards change and he's in there living a very successful life because he found a way to follow his genius. So when you look at that, I truly believe the truth of the idea that everybody has genius in them. Not everybody is Einstein. Everybody has an essence in their core that can, once you identify it, you can draw it out, you can nurture it, you can get rid of some of the distractors that would keep you from following your genius. And you, I think that's one of the goals is to find happiness and contentment in this world. And you have gifts, so let's find them and use them.
I agree. Now, you have also shared your genius and your passion with others, even in other countries. You've gone down to Mexico. You have gone to Africa. Can you share a little bit about how you've shared this idea of genius in those areas, either your genius or seeing the genius in others?
I went down as an eco-tourist to Mexico. I followed an invitation to help build homes for people living in the favelas, which is, you might be familiar with that term, but it's so common in Mexico that it has its own term. It's a slum. It's a community. It's of people who are off the grid. And it takes so little effort to improve the standards of living for an individual in the favela. And it may not fix the whole problem, but it certainly gives a person an opportunity to step up out of abject poverty. So I do that. I went there and it moved me and in a way changed my life because I now am addicted to service projects like that, the way some people are addicted to cocaine or something that's doing them damage. I feel so good when doing this kind of work, like a person who is using a narcotic feels so good, but I'm not doing anything illegal or immoral. I'm not doing anything that's going to cause me harm. And I really honestly struggle with wondering why other people aren't as addicted to this as I am, because it's such a wonderful feeling. And one of the things, I've been doing the building homes in favelas for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I built a couple hundred of them and they're sheds, US shed code. They're locking doors and all that. But where I really flourish, at first I went down there and I needed to show off with all the young guys. 30 years ago, I was a younger guy. who could carry more wood? Who could drive more nails with one hit with the hammer sets the nail and second hit sinks it because you're big, tough machismo. Yeah, that was fun and exhausting and all that. But as I got older, I realized I could let the young bucks try to impress the girls around them by carrying all the lumber. And I could just say, yeah, that lumber ought to be put over here. And I don't have to carry it. I'm not trying to impress anybody. But I got really attached to the children and the youth of the projects where we were. The little children that were maybe toddler age, the nonverbal were easy, just as easy for me to communicate with as nonverbals in US, because we don't have to have a common language. We just point and goo and all that other stuff. But having a relationship with the kids that mom boils their one school outfit every day at night and puts it out to dry, and they go to school the next day while we're doing construction in spotless white clothes, and they come back and they play soccer in a dirt lot near where we're building a shed for the family to live in, with a soccer ball made out of rags, or if you can believe it, I've seen soccer balls made out of crushed and tied together 2-liter plastic bottles. But they are expressing more joy at that soccer game than the kids that I know living in multi-million dollar homes experience, because they have all these other distractors that are trying to say, well, are we using the latest ball? Am I running with the latest shoes? Did my uniform match? Do my, you know, all these other things that are distracting. But the joy of the sport is sometimes secondary to all that other stuff. And when I'm working with the youth in Mexico, I encourage them and I goof with them, and I always carry in my top hat, I always carry at least 3 small plush toys. And I try not to overuse this, but whenever there's a perfect opportunity, I get the child's attention and I take the top hat off and I wave my hand over the rim, and I have a whole patter that I talk about and get their attention, even if they don't know what I'm saying. Just the tone of voice and the intensity of the look and all that. And then I pull a little plush toy frog out of my hat and I give it to them to keep. So first they're amazed that this gringo pulled out the plush toy frog out of his hat, who has a plush toy frog in their hat. But then they got a gift. They get to keep it. I'm not looking to have it back. I'm not demonstrating my skill. I am giving them the little frog. And then they tell that story to as many kids as it's, I'm that one guy again, right? But we try to help people flourish where they're planted. And it's not that kid's fault that the family is living in on the edges of a dump. Not like we would call an unattractive place a dump. I mean, literally, they're living on the edge of where the municipality dumps the refuse. And a lot of people are living off of the refuse of others. And it's really a startling place to be. But you can find people and draw out those things and give value to, help them recognize that, you know, they whistle better than any other kid I've ever heard whistle in Mexico. And that you should work on that. You should cherish that. You should not hide your talent and your ability at whistling. I don't know if you'll ever be able to monetize that, but isn't life with whistling happier than life suppressing whistling? Whistling brings out joy and all that. So, yeah. And in Africa, holy cow. I got to meet some people and become friends with them that survived the genocide in Rwanda. Terrible story. Yeah. Amazingly terrible story. With a truly unbelievable presence. I can't really call it an ending because it's still going. But where they have gone from genocide and neighbors murdering neighbors and hacking people to death with machetes. And one of my friends has no arms from the elbows down because they were hacked off with a machete when he was 15 and he was left in the jungle to die, to bleed to death. And he obviously managed not to, and spent a long period of time in a military hospital in a coma, but then an orphanage and worked his way up. He runs a program for disabled in Rwanda that is extraordinary. And it could be a model to the modern world. I mean, I cannot speak enough about what they do at their facility, but he came to the U.S. on a fundraising project, and where I met them, and we had became friends. And he has a person who is a friend of his who taught him English, so he had a more fluent understanding of English. We visited, and so his friend became more my friend because we could joke together. The nuance of language was fun, and I said, someday you might see a guy in front of your center wear the leather top hat. And they thought that was a great idea. The idea that somebody from California would travel all the way to Rwanda to see their center. And I got the opportunity to do so. And I gave out probably on the time I was in Africa, I probably gave out 480 plush toys out of my hat to kids and adults and other people just to get that attention. But it was also to share a connection and a magic. And we worked together building houses for a blind man. They didn't build them with wood like I was used to. It was stacked stone and stucco. And while I had worked with stucco before, I'll tell you, the little bit of stucco I got to put up on this blind man's house, it's lucky he's a blind man because he didn't know how to see the stuff I did. It was not good. And the guys that were working around me were very patient to let me fail slowly at the task and give me all kinds of accolades for the little patchwork I did that was terrible. And then as soon as I gave them the tools back, they were like, boom, whole project was done. You know, they were so skilled at it. And here I was flown all the way from Southern California to South Central Africa on the border with the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Central African Republics and all these tough spots with war and famine and plagues. You know, I'm out there. So what I did was the blind man also played the guitar. So I asked if I could borrow his guitar, and I sat on a stone and played guitar for the kids. And it didn't matter what I played. The kids were just enamored with it. And we played games. We played counting games in English and alphabet games in English, and everybody's trying to learn. But again, all of those kids have something in them. The adults do too, but sometimes adults, it's harder to pull it out because the adults have decades worth of scars, decades worth of people telling them you need to stop doodling and get a real job. And it's hard to find the doodling, especially if they're hiding the doodling. If my friend wouldn't do that, how would anybody else know that they were really good at the art? It's very hard to get through that. Children wear their genius on their sleeve. And I am, I don't know, maybe it's the Scots-Irish, but I'm attracted to I'm attracted to ornery people. But the kids that are problematic because they're labeled problematic because they won't sit still in class, or they're labeled problematic because they're easily distracted by something more colorful, or those are my favorite kids because they're easy to find the genius. Your lecture on the quadratic equations is just not it for them. They want to know about Spider-Man and how Spider-Man can get down a street in the suburbs where there aren't tall buildings to stick his web to. Well, let's talk about that. Maybe there are light standards along the streets that he can see. I mean, don't say, oh, that's just stupid. No, that's part of their genius. Let's draw out their curiosity. Let's draw out their question. Let's get them. They may be the next astrophysicist. And you don't know, but you have an opportunity to help.
Yeah. Well, Bill, one of the things I love about you is I have seen so many times how you just, by sharing your genius, you are nurturing other people's genius. So thank you so much today for being here and for sharing your genius. I know it will inspire other people's. And so thank you everyone for being here, and go out and realize your genius.
Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Realizing Genius podcast. Head over to realizinggenius.com/podcast for all the show notes and links, and to share your ideas of anyone you would like to have me interview. Have a wonderful week realizing your genius.